No music bumps. That's the way I love it. Never mind, Aubrey. Never mind. It's Rick Hogan. The show is called After Hours. And if you saw the Tribune earlier this week, you saw a story about a place called Givens Irish Castle on the south side of 103rd and Longwood Drive in the beautiful neighborhood of Beverly. The author of that book and the maker of a sort of companion documentary is Errol Magidson, who was in here with me, sitting here, excited to be on the radio, aren't you?
Very excited. Thank you so much for having me.
Errol, as you could have told from the book, I don't even know how I got this book. Did you just mail me this stuff?
Well, I knew you from Shirley Craven, a person that you've interviewed before.
Oh, I love Shirley.
And my editor, Linda Lamberty, knew you from
years ago at the Ridge Historical Society.
Exactly.
And you sent it, said, I wonder if you'd be interested in this. As you well know, I was fascinated by it.
Terrific.
And congratulations to you for doing it. It's hard to do the kind of book you have done in such a readable, compelling, and entertaining fashion. The movie, too. Let's go back. You and your first wife are driving around looking for a new place to live. You don't really know the South Side. You're all of a sudden at 103rd and Longwood Drive, and you look up and you see a castle.
I couldn't believe my eyes. I was just in absolute awe when I saw that. And after seeing that, I thought, oh my gosh, we gotta live in this community.
And you did. I mean, that was the catalyst for you moving and living for some time in Beverly.
Yes, that was it.
But the castle fascinated you beyond, like, well, this would be a cool place to live. I don't want to say it obsessed you, but you took that initial fascination to documentary lengths, to beautiful coffee table book lengths. What is it about that castle that got under your skin so and into your mind?
Well, I think, you know, every person wants to think of his home as a castle. That's
of course,
one thing. Because I knew there was a history of that castle. And at the time, I was trying to do, documentaries using the computer just to do, to have a family documentary. And I did one for my own family using free software. And it just, everything just fell in place, as you might say, because I was at a meeting of Men of the Castle, which was an organization affiliated with the Castle and Beverly Unitarian Church, of which there were members, including me at the time, and also friends. So I decided at a meeting there, Bill Diana, the president, said he had seen some photographs and some documents lying around the church office and thought maybe we should do something about it. He was thinking of a scrapbook. And when he said, what do you want to do? And so we went around the room and came to me, and I said, I'll do a documentary. Of course, I didn't even know what I was saying.
Yeah, of course not. And you had no clue at that point. You may have had a hint of the fascinating history of this.
Exactly. Basically, no clue is probably closer to the truth.
It's been a Unitarian church for some time now, since the
1942.
Since the 40s, and history tends a way of getting lost. How did you start your research? How, in the standard, let's go to a library?
In December of 2009, I just started looking online, just like people do
but
today.
But this is also after, nearly 30 years of living in the neighborhood, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
And had you heard, you must have known by then, because I've sensed it with friends of mine and all the many people I know who live in that neighborhood, you must have sensed on the part of the people, your neighbors, the fascination with this castle, right?
Yes. I mean, everybody knew about it. I mean, as far as people living in the neighborhood or people attending sending their children to the preschool there, people knew about that castle. You couldn't help but know about it. It's the icon of that community. And it should be much more well known.
See, that's to my point. When you start exploring this thing, do you not say to yourself, well, I'll just go buy the History of the Givens Castle book that was written in 1937? I mean, you must have assumed that there would be some kind of documentation, yes?
Yes, there was some documentation. For example, I knew about John Drury of the Chicago Daily News, who in 1939 was writing articles for the Daily News about what he thought were famous buildings in Chicago.
Yeah.
And number 13 was the castle. So that started me off. Also, Les O'Rear, who is a well-known labor historian, who was also a member of Beverly Unitarian Church, he wrote a pamphlet about the history of the castle. So I had basic information that I could use. It wasn't like I didn't have anything.
But but I must tell you, I mean, the research that you've done for this book, and again, the title of the book is Chicago's Only Castle. I got into some incredible argument with some guy after I wrote the story going, yeah, there's a castle building like in Joliet. And I said, yes, but the book is called Chicago's Only Castle. My guest for almost this entire hour is Errol Magidson, who is written this book, designed this book. He had a lot of help, and he's going to talk about the people who helped him do it and made a companion documentary. My recommendation would be for you to get both.
The dawn is filled with dreams.
That's the voice of Lori Shelley, who will be here in the 10 o'clock hour. This hour is devoted to Chicago's Only Castle, the history of Givens Irish Castle and its keepers by Errol Magidson. He put together the book. He put together the documentary. They are companion pieces. I would not buy one without buying the other. Where can people buy these? I'm asking you.
What's that?
Where can people buy these?
Well, of course, you can go through our website.
Which is a nice website, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much.
Chicagosonlycastle.org.
Correct.
Well worth, by everyone I know who's seen the movie, loves the movie. Okay.
And also, I should mention, yes, Bookies, the bookstore in Beverly, Bookies.
Mm-hmm.
You can find their phone number online. There's a link from our website, and they're offering the book with the DVD at a special price.
What is it?
It's actually about $44
for both. Oh, for God's sake. Well, you're obviously not in this to make a fortune, are you?
Well, remember, the proceeds of the book
are
going to the Castle Building Fund.
Which, because the castle is old now and it needs some repairs. The castle is a Unitarian church, but it was not. Who built it?
Well, it was Robert C. Givens. He had it built in 1886 and in part of 1887. And, of course, it was built on what is now the hill above Longwood Drive at 103rd Street.
He's a fascinating guy. He came to Chicago from Canada. He's Irish by heritage.
Yes.
But he came to Chicago from Canada, and I think, just to prove that I read the book, 1863 was something like 10,
oh, yes,
10 cents in his pocket, right?
Yes.
And he became, and this is a, Errol, this is a giant of Chicago history who I knew nothing about. Did mm-hmm. you know anything about him before starting to dig?
Not really. I mean, I don't even think I knew his name before I started to actually read.
Well, you must be terribly impressed by him.
I was very impressed. We call him a Renaissance man. That's what I think about him. I mean, he was a real estate developer. He developed a lot of the area around Chicago. I mean, as far as selling lots. And he was a founder of the Chicago Real Estate Board, which is now the Chicago Association of Realtors. He was
a novelist.
He was a novelist, too. He wrote several novels, some of them while he was living in the castle, as a matter of fact. And they were well known, and they were highly regarded.
One of the things, you make a case that he might have been inspired by a trip he took back to Ireland to see the homeland. He might have been inspired by a building he saw there. He might have been inspired by the water tower and the pumping station that survived the Chicago fire. He might have also been inspired by Potter Palmer, who built his larger, much larger castle at what is now about 1300 North Lakeshore Drive, torn down in 1950. The reason Palmer, as you well know, built his castle was because he owned half the land in what is now known as the Gold Coast. And he built it to convince the people from Prairie Avenue, most of the multimillionaires, to, hey, why don't we try this new place? What did Givens build his castle as a real estate notion?
Well, there are many historians who do believe that it was because...
What do you believe?
I think there's some partial truth in that. I mean, but I don't think that's the main reason. I'll tell you. There's other evidence that he wanted to live in the suburbs. He didn't want to live near the hustle bustle of the city of Chicago. You can only imagine with what was going on, during the time around when the castle was built.
Well, downtown Chicago was a mess.
Yes, it was a mess. It was muddy. It was,
it was busy.
Not the best.
It was smelly.
Right.
It was exactly. Dirty.
And there's evidence that, yes, he saw the water tower. In fact, he would have also seen Rose Hill Cemetery because his first wife was buried there. And the entryway was built by the same person who built the water tower.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's that he would have seen castles on trips to Ireland, for example, and other places around the world, because he did travel around the world.
Well, he traveled a lot. I mean, he lived for a time. He didn't live, all the time at the castle. They lived at the Lexington Hotel,
correct,
as you point out,
yes,
the future home of Al Capone.
Right.
And they traveled. They traveled considerably. He died eventually in San Francisco.
He was visiting.
Yeah.
He didn't live there, but he was visiting San Francisco at the time. And, of course, he was much older. He probably lived in the Lexington Hotel part of the time because, first of all, it had elevators.
Elevators, you
he
point
had
that
rheumatism.
Out, yeah.
It would have been hard for him to walk up and down the stairs. He was a big man. The legend is that he saw a castle in Ireland. One legend is that he saw it on a trip from Dublin to Belfast and saw it in County Louth. There is a castle there. Smarmore, that looks a little bit
a little.
Like
you have a picture.
Not exactly.
A little. Right. A
yeah.
little.
And then there's one, and the River Lee, which is in County Cork in the southern part, most part of Ireland, that's a possibility, Blackrock Castle. And the reason I say that is because Givens' grandfather was a relative of Henry Hamilton, and Hamilton was born and raised there in County Cork.
Interesting. You know, one of the things in doing a book like this, and it is very, very solidly researched, is you have to get through some of the fables and myths that surround any portion of history. And there's always been that myth in Beverly, especially on the part of young girls in Beverly, that he built it for his fiance and he had the limestone brought in from Ireland. Not true.
Yes, not true. None of that was true. I mean, the limestone came from Joliet or around Joliet. And Drury said it came on wagons, horse-driven wagons. From
the train
Joliet.
Station.
But it really didn't. Drury didn't know that it came. It really came on the Rock Island.
Yeah, as you point out. And then you come up, horse-drawn carriages would bring it up the hill.
Right, which makes a lot more sense.
You
than,
also give due to the man who built it.
Pete Millen.
Yeah, who, talk about a guy fading into history. I mean, this...
Right. Nobody knows about him. And that's unfortunate because he built a number of homes in Beverly. And in particular, of course, the castle.
Yeah.
And we know that from his youngest daughter, who was still alive in the 1970s, I think it was. And she was interviewed by the Ridge Historical Society. We had that.
When you have the tape, I mean, it's in the movie. I mean, that's why you need to buy the book and the movie, and they are sort of companion pieces. The movie came first.
Yes.
Errol, why is that?
Well, that was it. I mean, the idea was to do a documentary, so that was the whole idea. It just, and I enlisted people who were very, very helpful and more than helpful. I mean, so for example, Josh Van Tiel became the videographer and the main director, I would say, for this. He knew how to edit the software. He's the one who recommended the professional software that we used, and that's the same software, Adobe Premiere Pro, that's used to make some Hollywood movies. And of course, even before I enlisted Josh, there was Linda Lamberty of the Ridge Historical Society, and Mary Quinn Olson was a consultant, and Renee Wilson, she became the harpist and did the
Yeah, there's
music.
A soundtrack. It's a great soundtrack, and I'm sure the people at the Beverly Unitarian Church were beyond helpful to you, right?
They were very supportive in they said, you know, go for it.
Yeah.
I wish they had given me some money to do it, but that was okay. You know, they
Well, see, basically, this is a shoestring kind of operation. This
exactly.
is the result of your passion and the passion of people like Linda Lamberty and Josh and all these others to make this come to life. You guys, you're not obsessed by it, but you knew
right.
in diving into this that this story needed to be told.
Exactly. And then the book, and this is something I think we need to recognize, the book, how I got major support from my wife, Nancy. If it wasn't for Nancy, this book would never have gotten completed because it basically took years for me to get this thing done.
Well, and because
and
also
it supported that.
It's always on your mind. I haven't met Nancy, but she must be very saintly because I know what it's like to live with an author who wants to tell you, honey, I just found out something else about Robert C. Givens. And she's going, oh, honey, I'm up to here with Robert C. Givens. We will go through in the next segment of the show the other people who lived in that house. It was for 2 years or so. They rented it. The Givens family rented it to the women's.
Chicago, right.
The Chicago Women's
Female College.
The Chicago Female College, and they changed the castle into a school. It just is a fascinating book. You can get a lot of information and buy it and the film, and I recommend buying them as a package at chicagosonlycastle.org. Errol's going to be here for the rest of this hour talking about the Burdett family, the Siemens family. That guy's, and they're all interesting. I mean, because who? You know, the point being, who would live in a castle? I suppose, you know, Ken Griffin, Illinois' richest man, if he could afford it, would buy it from the church and live there, but he has other things on his mind. But it takes a very special kind of person to say, hey, I want to live in a castle. And you catalog it beautifully. We'll be back after the news. Hear Lori Shelley sing later in the show. I'm carrying on with Errol Magidson, the author of Chicago's Only Castle, History of Givens Irish Castle and Its Keepers, a lovely, deeply researched and beautifully written book, and also a very compelling and entertaining documentary that's kind of a companion piece. They do embellish each other. We've talked about the guy who built the castle on 103rd and Longwood and still standing today as the Beverly Unitarian Church. This Givens character was not only did he write novels, not only did he build this thing, not only was he a major real estate developer in this town, he was also touted at one point as a possible mayoral candidate, wasn't he?
That's correct. In 1897, as a matter of fact, he was on the cover of a Chicago newspaper called the Chicago Eagle. And it, under the caption was something about Robert C. Givens talked about for mayor.
It is fascinating. It is fascinating how so many prominent people fade under history's dust. It continually astonishes me. But the castle is still there, and they rented it to these the women's college people, and then they rented it to a fascinating, but not rented it, they sold it to the Burdett family, right? Who were these people?
Right, and that was, they sold it in at the end of 1908. It was 1909 when the Burdetts moved in there. J.B. Burdett was an inventor. He made elevator parts. He and oxygen tanks. And, you know, he was
successful, very,
very successful. But also, he was an early automobilist. He had automobiles before 1900. He was in a rather famous race that took place in 1901 from Chicago to the courthouse in Joliet. That's a 40-mile race. And in those days, the cars, they didn't call them cars. They called them machines. His machine, I mean, did not have a dashboard. None of them did. You're just out there and gale force winds against the cars.
On really horrible roads, too.
On horrible roads.
The great thing about it, Errol, as you point out in the book and in the film, is his wife was an active participant in these automobile races.
Well, certainly in that one she was, and boy, she was quite a beautiful gal, too.
No question. No question.
We have a picture from the family, actually, in the book. And
they lived at the house for a long time.
Oh, yes. They lived there until about 1921, and the other story that I just have to tell,
yeah, sure,
besides that race, the story about how J.B. was riding in his automobile in Lombard in 1904. Now, keep in mind, 1904, that's a rural area, and there's a lot of farmland over there, and farmers hate cars, machines,
yeah,
and they hate the drivers. And
sure.
This is a story where they set up a speed trap in
just
the summer
to catch this guy.
Well, I don't know if it was against him personally, but it was, you know, they
set up a speed
trap.
Well, there couldn't have been that many
probably not that
machines
many cars
out there,
yeah, exactly,
at the time.
So they set up a speed trap, and so a farmer hid behind, I don't know if it was a tree, whatever. So he's got a gun. And then his buddy is a traveling salesman, as a matter of fact, but he situates himself supposedly a quarter mile away. And he's got a watch, and he's going to time the driver of any car that goes by, so by the first person. So evidently, Burdette drives he gets to this first person, this farmer, and the farmer shoots the gun off. Okay, so then the traveling salesman has his watch, and he's looking at it, and as soon as Burdette gets by him, he automatically has the time, and he computed the speed of the car at 12 miles an hour, definitely too high, and so Givens was Burdette was arrested, and there was a trial. And evidently, this trial, it made the newspapers, and according to one story, just about everybody in the whole community showed up for the trial. It didn't matter that they were farmers and had to do farming. They were there at the trial because they wanted to see,
like the Scopes Monkey trial or something.
They wanted to see Burdette punished. And they wanted to see the slick Chicago lawyer that he would have with him. They wanted to see that guy lose. So anyways, when Burdette testified, he said he was not going faster than 8 miles an hour.
What a case.
And evidently, the judge decided, I don't think it was a jury trial, I think the judge decided, okay, he's free. He didn't do it. So
they eventually sold to Miroslav and Bonnie Siemens. They were the last family.
Yes.
To own the castle. These people are fascinating, too. He's a
medical doctor.
Yeah, who works mostly at Roseland Community Hospital.
Yes.
He also founds the Ukrainian National Museum here.
He's a founder of the museum, Ukrainian National Museum.
They raised their kids here, didn't they?
Yes. And we interviewed Miroslav Siemens Jr., So he was in his 90s when we interviewed him, and he was just terrific.
He looks pretty good in the movie, but he has a great affection. He loved growing up there. How could you not love growing up there?
Loved growing up in a castle. And then he decided when he went to the Sutherland Elementary School, but when he was in fifth grade, or when he was going to go in the fifth grade, he decided he was going to go walk down to the Catholic church and
That's
get into the Catholic school there.
That is such a great story, how he
Saint
goes
Barnabas.
In. It's like a dollar a month or something. I can't remember.
Right.
He wants to go to a Catholic school, so he walks down and like enrolls himself, right?
Exactly. Well, he, you know, yes, exactly. He asked
now,
permission
why did
to
they
go. and they gave it to him.
Remind me, they sold to the Beverly Unitarian Fellowship, actually, in 1942. Why, yes. Why did they sell?
Well, they wanted during to move? The Depression,
mm-hmm.
Siemens lost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a real problem because, you know, I mean...
Because he had no money.
He had a mortgage,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, and... So it was very difficult times for them, and eventually they did have to sell. And at the time, the church actually was known as People's Liberal Church,
right?
And it
right,
was located
right.
in Englewood.
Yep.
There's a lot of history there too.
Yeah, a lot of good, fascinating.
But
history.
In any case, this story goes that the minister. And the minister's wife, and also Clara Nieberger,
mm-hmm.
Were driving their car. And,
just like you, decades later.
They
yeah.
saw the
yeah.
castle, and the minister said, yeah, that would maybe make a fine church. And Clara Nieberger said, yeah, I think, and I hear it's for sale. And they stopped over there. And they were met by a Ukrainian Catholic priest.
Yep,
that was
I know
Miroslav Siemens' father.
And the deal was cut, and that is
it,
what it's
yeah,
been
they
ever
for,
since. There was one at one
yes.
point; it almost moved. They almost decided to get rid of the building, did they not?
That
at
is
one
correct.
Point.
This goes back into the latter part of the 1950s. It was decided that maybe, you know, it's too hard to take care of the castle.
Yeah.
Let's make a modern church. They had drawings done. They also had 100 children in the Sunday school. They were getting new members. They needed the space. They thought, okay, let's...
let's modernize. Who wants a castle? I think... It was the best decision they made not to do that.
Thank goodness for that. I'm sure there were people in the community as well as members
sure.
of the church who said, no way.
Yeah,
but they did, unfortunately, they tore down what was known
right.
as the porte-cochère that the Burdettes had put up
yeah.
for their car. You know, the Burdettes had made a driveway all the way around the castle. But anyway, they had this porte-cochère, which... They made it look. The Burdettes made it look as though it was original.
Well,
those
Burdettes, were car crazy.
Yeah,
those Burdettes were car crazy. We'll take our last little break, and I'll spend.
Love their cars.
Huh? Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
I would not want to drive one though. I would have crashed in about half
right.
a second. We'll be back after a short commercial break. I have nothing to read for you, so just play the commercials. That's Lori Shelley. She'll be in here after 10 to talk about her new CD and the release party at the Jazz Showcase. I have 5 more minutes left with Errol Magidson, the author, the eminent historian. He's had a career in academia teaching all sorts of other things. You should have been a historian. ChicagosOnlyCastle.org is where you can learn more about the book and the DVD documentary. You should buy them because they're so reasonably priced, I mean, under $50. If you care anything about the history of Chicago, you should have these books. And if you are a Southsider, this is high time that one of your most famous buildings gets the recognition it deserves. It's a fascinating story, that castle at the corner of 103rd and Longwood, that whenever Mike Flannery sees on his drive home, he knows he's almost home. He lives a few houses north of that castle. So the church takes it over in 1942, Errol, and it starts there's a preschool there that you know, generations of Beverly children, that's how they know the castle. It was their preschool, right?
Exactly. When the addition was built to the castle, it basically was used as an office and then as a preschool.
Yeah.
First a Sunday school, and then
right.
members of the church, they decided to make it a non-sectarian preschool, which is what
thing.
They did.
Yeah.
And so in the early 60s, kids in the neighborhood started to to attend. These were, you know, preschoolers, 3 to 5 or whatever. And Helen Malavides was one of the persons who owned it for many years, and now Kelly Seiss has it. And it's just terrific because the kids, they still call it, there's my castle. There's the castle. And, I mean, you've got kids now who are adults. They're all
sure
over
do.
The United States.
Yeah.
And I've bumped into a number of these people as well, you know, as adults, and tell me about, the castle. We know it. I went there in preschool.
No, it holds a very, very dear place in the hearts of anybody who grew up, certainly in that neighborhood. And still, because you can see it, it's still there, for God's sake. All right, is there a ghost or not a ghost?
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who believe in ghosts.
Yeah, I know.
You can't convince them otherwise. We cannot debunk every single ghost story.
Of
and
course
they're great
not.
Stories. I tell them in the book. One story that's sort of a legend was that Givens was a mad eccentric and that his wife snuck through a tunnel to be with the stable master.
That's right.
To meet with the stable master and that left the poor Givens brokenhearted. But that story turns out it's not exactly a ghost story, but it turns out that there may be some truth there.
Yeah,
but it wasn't Givens. It was his son. His son was married, got divorced, and this lady whom he divorced, she met this driver, this chauffeur for a very wealthy man. The chauffeur told her that he was the son of the wealthy man. They eloped. And she found out he wasn't the son, but anyway, they still, I think, got married. But that's probably where the story came from. You know how legends just...
Oh,
get,
sure.
Yeah.
Well, the legend of importing the limestone from Ireland and building it for this.
Right.
You are now more than willing to go places and talk about and show the... DVD and
oh, yes.
Talk about the history of this place.
Well,
aren't you?
You've done
some programs
sure.
at Beverly Arts Center.
I've done some
Arts
programs.
Center.
Basically, they're using, I'm showing images, and multimedia programs that involve some music, that involve lots of these images that I have, and telling the wonderful stories that we don't even have, we haven't told even too many of them here. We could tell a lot more.
Told a few. No, there are dozens. I mean, there are dozens of good, compelling, fun, interesting,
sure.
And, you know, some heartwarming, some crazy stories involving this castle. It's one of Chicago's unique buildings, and this is a city of famous and notable architecture, and this is one. It may not be, you know, considered up there with Adler and Sullivan masterpieces, but it is in its way a masterpiece because it does represent that neighborhood.
Right, and plus it's a castle. Like, everybody wants their home to be a castle.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Earl Magidson, you and your wife, your long-suffering wife, Nancy, who's like, I'm up to here, don't tell me another Given story. You've done a remarkable job, and continued success with this, and keep me posted on your adventures, and... I guess that's you've done a book and a DVD. Unless Steven Spielberg wants to make a feature film, you've got what you've got, and you did a remarkable job.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh my God, you were great. You're an ideal. Anybody could talk about the history of Chicago and ghosts is the ideal guest for this show. We'll take a short break, and you'll hear a movie review from our critic at large, Zita Moore. Welcome back. As you know, our critic at large, Zita Moore, generally reviewing theater, is branched out into movies. And I so want to see this movie. And because of her review, I want to see it even more. Here is Zita Moore reviewing Call Me By Your Name.
I'm grateful to have watched the film Call Me By Your Name in the company of my thoughts, nestled in the warmth of my living room. It afforded me the experience of reveling in the awe monks of yore immortalized with their renderings of the holy firmament. Indeed, the film transports you to an Arcadia of the mind, a time when the youths of the world fell hopelessly, helplessly in love with love. A breathtakingly lush Italian hideaway in the 1983. Need I say more? Yes, because the moment the star of Luca Guadagnino's film appears, you understand no ordinary story has ensnared you. Elio, played by Timothée Chalamet, carries the film aloft on the map of his face that bears the burning constellations of his awakening. Oliver, played by Armie Hammer, breezes into his life with the breathless possibility of a summer storm. On a visit of academic importance at the behest of Elio's father, played with remarkable tenderness by Michael Stuhlbarg, Oliver devotes himself to his research of classical sculpture. But one cannot stay away from Elio for long. Both of them know that what comes to pass may not last. Yet watching them dive headlong into the surging waves of temptation and adoration begets a renewed faith in the astonishing hold love sustains over one's life. The ineffable emotion shimmers through every action of Elio's mother, played by Amira Kassar. His closest friend, Marzia, played by Esther Galel, remains also a faithful, amorous companion, despite a dawning comprehension of Elio's deepening self-realization. Stuhlbarg's acknowledgement of his son's journey serves as a precedent for all parents. Take heed. Allowing your offspring to own their identity while also reminding them of your love may sound daunting. You can do it, though, and you must. And this film can help you do it the right way. On a similar note, the film serves as a dazzling introduction to the music of Sufjan Stevens, although sometimes the lyrics prove a bit too on the nose. The inclusion of Ravel's Mother Goose Suite more than makes up for it. Of course, the film certainly helped me in providing me with an actor I intend to follow my whole life long. Chalamet, as far as I'm concerned, ranks with the pantheon of unforgettable portrayals in cinema. In the opinion of the New Yorker film critic Anthony Lane, he acts as if by a force, not of this planetary existence. Watch him. Go fall in love.
Zita Moore, you're the greatest. You are just the greatest. That was Zita Moore's review of the movie Call Me By Your Name, which I certainly have to see. I've always trusted Zita for a long time on theater, and now that she's back doing theater, I guess maybe you'll do a book next, Zita. I know you're up listening. Thank you, honey. Thank you. Lori Shelley's coming in. We're going to hear some music from her new CD, and then we're going to talk to the one and only Zay Smith, because the 40th anniversary of one of the great investigative series in the history of this town, the Mirage Tavern, celebrating its 40th anniversary. That is not Lori Shelley's new CD. The new CD, an EP, is called Time is a Healer, and she's going to have her CD release party this Wednesday at the Jazz Showcase. Lori, welcome to the show. You're here with your great husband, Lee Montgomery, one of my favorite people on the planet. You're waving. Who are you waving to? Oh, you can't. You don't need these headphones. Take them off. I'm not taking any phone calls.
True.
I'm not taking any phone calls.
Oh.
Someone would call in and
I
go,
felt so professional.
Like I listen to jazz music. This is a very, very important CD for you in lot of different ways, isn't it, Lori?
It is. It's, very, very much important. It is, it's my music that has come from my soul, and it is the first time that I am releasing a CD of my music.
Yeah. Was it hard to do? You have had a full career in music. You have played around the world. You have played in clubs of every conceivable size.
All over,
you have the great Michel Legrand, who won a bunch of Oscars. I guess he won a bunch
of Oscars, five Grammys.
Is that right?
Over 200 movies scored.
I guess that's a considerable amount. You traveled the world singing with him. But also your background even before Michel Legrand, and you guys hooked up when you were probably like a late teenager.
I met
teenager.
Him when I, with Michel.
Yeah.
I met him, I was 19 years
19.
Old.
19. But the thing that has always impressed me about you is your musical, you were open to musical influences from all
over.
Over the, yes. Why is that?
Probably because I love it all, you know, and there was never any boundaries for me. Everything from classical to, you know, Broadway to country to gospel. I used to watch Jubilee Gospel.
Sure,
when I was like nine.
Sure.
Jubilee Showcase.
Produced by Sid Ortauer.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, nobody said, watch that. You know, I'd be sitting on the floor in the den all by myself watching it. And then, you know, the shows at night, Andy Williams, Glenn Campbell, you name it. So everything, I was like a sponge. You know, whatever it was, I loved it. Even bluegrass.
Talk to me a little about your childhood. I know that it was kind of a tough childhood.
Very.
One of the things that has made you, I think, such a resilient human being is having overcome that kind of, it was emotionally tough, right?
It was pretty tragic. It was a very hard upbringing. So all the tools and the growth, the stuff to help you grow that it would be a somewhat normal childhood so that you could become who you are, who you should be, who what's there was not given to me.
Yeah, and so as a result, it takes, you know, and the kind of life you had when all of a sudden at 19 you're traveling the world, it doesn't really give you that chance for a while to sit and get to know your life's moving too fast,
when I met
and it's
him,
too much fun.
Yeah, when I met him, that's why I'm, you know, I'm learning a lot now. A lot of things are coming together for me just within myself, so that all these songs and everything that I'm writing, it's a very cathartic thing. I'm on my way, you know, I've arrived, and as far as what I've done from where I'm from, I'm surprised. I look now and I go, I can't believe I accomplished what I did. You know, I walked into Mr. Kelly's, hello, how are you, love your music, and somehow talked him into playing for me. And it was like I was thrown right away into the, if you want to say, the big time of music. You know,
that's the big time, yeah.
Right away. I mean, there was no, we'll call you in 5 months. It
right.
was instant, within weeks. I was, you know, getting a call. You know, there was always a ticket at the airport, and 5.5 years of that. It was there was no schooling for this.
No apprenticeship.
Nothing. And I was on my own, on the road, on my own.
Wow.
So
let's listen. What do you want to hear? I want people to go to Jazz Showcase this coming Wednesday night to celebrate the... I know it's called an EP release, but even Mike Jeffers will be okay with me. I call it a CD release party. The title, and we will talk about the title, is called "Time Is a Healer." These are your songs.
That was written to myself too, so it's interesting what we just.
What do you want to hear? That great Aubrey Mumpower, the engineer, is back there, and he will.
Well, last time we did play. Not that I wouldn't mind hearing it again, but should we try?
Which one do you guys want to hear?
We could try It's Not the Way It Used to Be. It's
How about, Aubrey, if we could, It's Not the Way It Used to Be. I don't know what cut that is. Do you know what cut that is?
It's the fourth cut.
Fourth cut. And if it's not, then we'll hear it later.
I'll sing it for you.
Then Laurie Shelley will sing it. Here, ladies and gentlemen, is the voice you will hear if you go to the Jazz Showcase Wednesday night.
I just don't understand. I don't want to believe. What it is that makes me shiver, what it is that shakes me when I'm thinking of you. Words we said from the start, and words that promise I do, just fade away and lose the meaning till we say there's no more feeling, I'll stay with you. So I think about the days that seem so far away, and then I find when I'm alone, I gently whisper your name. Oh, but the rain keeps falling down, and it's falling down on me. Remind me, somehow know just where to find me, waiting for you. So I think about the days that seem so far away, and then I find when I'm alone, I gently whisper your name. Oh, oh. But the rain keeps falling down, and it's falling down on me.
Shelley, that is a great tune. You're going to be singing that Wednesday at the Jazz Showcase. We will hear more from Lori about her life and times, which are reflected, which are the, I think, the fuel of this new CD. What she's been through and how she's lived and how she feels are manifested in these songs on this new EP. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Lori Shelley's the CD release concert is Wednesday. Two shows at 8 and 10 at the one and only Jazz Showcase. Lori also has a website. It's Lori, L-A-U-R-Y, Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y.com. That's kind of like down at the moment. We'll be back in action immediately.
It's about to be launched.
She's going to be playing with Ben Lewis, John Sims, John Mulder, Vance Okrasuski, Aledo Poveda, Suzanne Palmer, Renee Ledesma. Some of these people I know. This is a big show. I mean, this is big. You got backup singers?
Yes, yes. Suzanne Palmer and Renee Ledesma, they're tremendous singers and my friends. And I just can't wait for this. We had a rehearsal the other night, and we were just having a ball.
Lori, when people realize, when especially your friends in the jazz community realize the meaning behind many of these songs, it must enrich the experience for them, yes?
Yes, because it isn't. This is not really like a straight-ahead jazz.
And no kidding.
And it's, you know, there's going to be, of course, I'm going to do everything. The first set, I will say, for anybody listening, yes, we're going to do wonderful music, both sets. The first set is really going to have all my original songs. And I will be doing songs from artists that I love, also mixing it in from everybody from Sting, Michael McDonald, Brian Adams, Jamie Cullum, Josh Groban. I don't want to say everybody.
Yeah.
And, of course, always Michelle LeBron.
Of course. Of yes. course. Now, are you at all, you've performed thousands of times, Lori Shelley. Are you at all nervous about something like this? Because this one is sort of intensely personal for you.
I've been so busy.
Okay. Wearing 75
different hats.
Too busy to be nervous.
I, you know, you just want everything done.
And yeah,
you just
sure.
Want, but always, sure, you know, before, you know, there's the butterflies. I mean, if you don't have that, then once you're up there, it starts to just feel good. And, you know, I mean, you're
excited. Well, and there's no, and, you know, with all due respect to other places, there's no better place to play in this town.
No, that's why we're back there. We were there, and I was here.
I remember.
June 28th, and we're there again. I've been there 9 times now. This will be my 10th time. Thank you, Wayne and Joe Siegel.
Joe Siegel.
And I love being there, you know.
No club quite like it.
And
in
everybody
this country.
That was there, especially the last time, commented, some people that have never been there, that we had an incredible turnout. They loved it. They thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great club.
It's got a vibe there. I mean, you know, look, it's, you know, the jazz showcase. It's...
Now, what do you want to hear now? Because I want people to get a real taste of you and your music. What did you I know we told Aubrey and Lise, the great engineer, and what are we going to hear? Well, tell me a little about the song before
we
hear it.
This is called In the Rain, and it, like... When you write, you know, it just kind of comes to you anytime, 3 in the morning, 12 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And this is really a pretty commercial song, and it gets kind of full in the, I think it's about hope.
It's about hope.
Well, you know,
it's good
I mean,
enough for
it's,
me.
It's yeah. funny. When I wrote it, I was like, what does that mean? In the rain. But I just think it's romantic. It's kind of haunting. And it just, there's a light, you know, shining in the rain. So,
a hopeful, romantic song. Aubrey Mumpower, if you would, please.
So near, it sounds so crystal clear, but you're not really there. I'm alone, I'll never let you down. Now that my heart is found, I cherish every sound, miss you so. But it feels so right that it's time to let you know that it's time for us to find a better way. And I believe somewhere the answer's in the rain. In the rain.
so sweet, so clear, follows me everywhere, everywhere I go. One thing I know for sure is that I want you more. My love, my life, my world and my soul. But it feels so right that it's time to let you know that it's time for us to find a brighter day. Oh, don't go away. There's so much I wanted to say that it's time for us to find a better way. To find a better way.
Wow. Not exactly jazz, Laurie Shelley, but I loved it. I loved it. That, again, is from Laurie's new EP, as they call it. I call it a CD. It is titled Time is a Healer. You'll hear a little more, and we'll talk some more after the news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Thank you, Roger Benish. I have a few more minutes with Laurie Shelley. You can have a couple hours with her Wednesday night at the Jazz Showcase. The shows are 8 and 10. She's with a ton of people. The Jazz Showcase on Plymouth Court is as nice a jazz room. If you've never been there, just go to jazzshowcase.com. It'll tell you everything you need to know. Laurie, this is a big moment for you. You've written these songs. You're going to perform other songs, too, by some of your favorite composers. But your life has taken I think, really sort of healthy turn. Your husband, Lee Montgomery, has a huge part of this. It's not like you guys just got married, but, you know, you've been together for a long time, and that is his participation in this is essential, is it not?
Very, very. I mean, I met him when he was the voice of Welcome to Miller Time, and he came here to audition for another commercial, and he never left.
I don't blame him, but he also, I mean, I can sense it when you two are together, what a huge supporter he is of you.
Very, very huge.
And this journey to write your own songs and explore your own feelings, you got to have a companion on that, don't you?
Yeah, we're very connected. I'd say soulmates. And in fact, when I started writing, a musician said, you know, we were doing a gig, and he said, you know, you should try writing, because when you ad lib, it's like a song. So
yeah.
I don't know why, what, or it just it stuck, and it triggered something in me, and I started to write. And the first song I wrote was for Lee, called When You're Away From Me, which is not on my EP, but I am going to
record it. It will be on
the big one, and it will be performed that night. So
oh,
that
fantastic.
Was the first song.
It is always great to see both of you, and I am I'm thrilled that you're taking the step, because, as you know, it is, you know, a lot of artists can just rest on their, you know, and you have previous success like crazy. And you could rest on that, but the fact that you're pushing yourself and you're pushing your own creativity and you're doing something new.
I'm just starting.
Feels
that way for me.
Exactly.
You know?
I'm going to let you walk out of here hearing one last song. What's it going to be? What do you want to hear?
How about the title of the album,
Time? The title track, Time is a Healer, Aubrey. We don't cut number something.
It is number 3.
Number 3, Lori and Lee, it's always great to see you. Knock 'em dead Wednesday night.
Wonderful.
Wednesday night at Jazz Showcase.
Thank you so much,
two
Rick.
Shows. My pleasure. My pleasure.
Thank
both
you.
Of you.
Time is a healer now. Hush, baby, in a hurry, I'll be there with a guiding light. Isn't it all so clear? You believe what you want to hear. It's tearing you apart, 'cause you've been living your life with an empty heart. Someone to lift that cloud. How you could be so blind? Tell me, why does love have its own mind? In time you'll turn it around, when you stop looking through somebody else's eyes.
welcome back. Again, Lori Shelley will be at Jazz Showcase Wednesday with the release of her EP. We will take a little break, and then we will talk to my old dear colleague, Zay Smith, because 40 years ago, there was a 25-part series in the Sun-Times, the most notable newspaper investigative series that I, of my lifetime, certainly, about the Mirage. Zay was part of it. He was Norty the bartender at a place called the Mirage, and we'll talk about it after we take a break for a minute. Welcome back. 40 years ago, it seems almost impossible to me, some of my friends, they didn't really let me in on what they were doing, but they opened a bar on Wells Street called the Mirage. They opened the door and let what happened happen. One of those friends was Pam Zekman. Another one was Bill Rechtenwald. And my best friend of that bunch was Zay Smith. Zay, it is almost impossible for me to believe that that was 40 years ago. Are you serious? I'm trying to talk to Zay on the phone, but there's no... He was called at the time. He had a sort of secret name, because what happened was Pam Zekman convinced Jim Hoag, the editor of the Chicago Sun-Times, that one interesting way...
Rick, can you hear me?
Yes. Oh, Norty, okay. I thought you'd fallen off your bar stool or something.
No, the phone suddenly went silent.
And I refer to you as Norty because that was your name at the Mirage. I really am having a terribly hard time believing that this was 40 years ago because you and I seem so young and vibrant. Do you have the same problem?
Yes, I do. But I'm glad to go back. You know, I could be an undercover customer at any tavern.
Well, that was, it was originally Pam's idea. Pam pitched it to Jim Hoag, right? Saying very simply, why don't we just buy a bar, open the doors and see what happens, right? Basically. Yeah.
She had tried for years to sell it elsewhere. And everybody was afraid of it and had meetings about it and turned it down. And then she came to the Sun-Times and she was out with Jim Hoag in the Loop, and they were walking back to the paper and at the south end of the Michigan Avenue Bridge. And he said, "You have any projects in mind?" And she gulped and said, "Well, I'd like to open a tavern." And she explained why, and he okayed the project by the time they reached the other end of the bridge.
You know, one of the things, and you got involved in it very early on, and not that Pam is not a great writer, but you wrote the majority of the, I think it was it 25 pieces? 25 pieces?
Yeah, Pam can write.
Yes,
she
I know.
She always says she can't write, but she'd rather be reporting. She'd rather be reporting, so I wrote the series.
When they asked you to join the thing, one of the things was it had to be kept very, very, very quiet because there was another newspaper across the street called the Tribune that would have jumped all over this and tried to scuttle it somehow. Basically, you open the doors.
And another newspaper called the Daily News.
Oh, my God, the Daily News. And yeah, I think I don't remember when the American was there. Yeah, I was working for the Daily News. You kept it quiet in the building that the Sun-Times shared with the Daily News. It must have been for you, Zay Smith, just one remarkable day after another where you were meeting. You know, you certainly weren't naive about the way this city runs and the crooked way this city often runs, but it must have been a kind of stunning, grotesque revelation every day when these goofs walked in the door. Tell me about a few of them.
Well, even Pam, who had done a lot of reporting in this area, was astonished. Just everybody who came through the door virtually either had his hands out or was offering to make a fix, the inspectors, the vending salesmen, and so forth. We ran into one honest, person from the city, and he was our licensing officer, the police officer who did the licensing with Tavern, and he was saying everything has to be right. And we had to report the hell out of it because it's very easy to see somebody's over there. He's doing something wrong, but to say that somebody's honest, that's a lot to prove. And anyway, we wrote a story about him, Officer Luke Cuddy, the one honest person we ran into. And we found out later he was ostracized
for being honest. Yeah, he was blackballed for being honest. Yeah. You worked in collaboration. Much of it was done in collaboration with the BGA, now run by the one and only Andy Shaw. But he also, how did 60 Minutes and Mike Wallace get involved in that whole thing?
Well, they found out in ways that we can't quite. There was a leak, and they found out, and Stu Lurie, our managing editor at the time, they wanted to come in and do it. And I'll be frank: 60 Minutes at that time had a reputation as a story stealing type of outfit.
Sure.
And Stu Lurie made them sign a document about as long as the closing document when you buy a house, about when they would cover, what they could do, who they would check with. They could not run the first story. They could not run their story until ours had run for a week and that sort of thing. And then in came 60 Minutes and did a very nice piece on the Mirage.
How hard was it for you as the, I don't think in all the time I've known you, I'm not sure I ever asked you this before, but how difficult a writing chore was this for you? Because there were some aspects of it that were kind of feature-ish about, some of the non-corrupt but somewhat dark businesses that operated in the vicinity of the place. How did you structure this narrative? That's a lot of stories in a row to keep people interested. And I remember everybody being riveted by the series. How did you do that?
There's a school of thought that investigative stories have to be very dry and serious, almost solemn.
Yeah. You know? Sure.
And it was my feeling, especially with the Tavern, that even the more serious pieces of the Graft, whatever, could be written well. I mean, could be written to be a good read.
Didn't you at one point, didn't you go to bartending school? Wasn't that one of the pieces?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I learned how to mix 86 drinks. We didn't. We were suddenly running a bar, and none of us knew what to do.
Yeah, right.
So
exactly.
I went to a 1 week bartending school, and we thought and made a story out of it. Maybe the bartending school would tell us how to cheat on our taxes and our tips. Who knew? But I learned how to make. I came in third after two housewives in the final exams, and then I went back to the Sun Times and started pouring beers. I mean, Pam thought a shot in a beer, she won't mind me saying this, she thought a shot in a beer, you poured the shot into the beer.
I'm sure she did.
We were not equipped to run a tavern at that moment that we took it over.
Well, and eventually the work was collected in a book of the Mirage that you can still buy, I guess, online at various places, but also that is sort of continually interested movie producers over the years. I mean, I think now Zay Smith with these kind of Amazon sort of semi series that run, its time has probably come. Remind me of, there were not a bunch of indictments. It was not that kind of investigative series. It was kind of corruption on its lowest level, which I thought was so much more telling than the guy who takes $10,000 to, rezone a lot or something. Did you not think that? Yeah.
We're not high. We got $100 here, $70 there, and we called it the supermarket approach to graft, to high volume, low prices.
Yeah.
And that's what ran, because if you were running a small business and everybody who came in had his hand out for $100.
Yep. Yeah.
It was tough.
Wow.
But it was we just let the city come in and do work its will on us and see what there was.
That's what was.
And there were results. There were changes in procedures.
Sure.
And people did go to jail. But I think In fact, one of my favorite is the Illinois Department of Revenue, when we showed how much fraud was going on with taxes on cash businesses, founded a unit just to look at cash businesses, and they called it the Mirage Audit Unit.
Well, you can celebrate. Zay Smith, Pam Zechman, Bill Rechtenwald, and a number of other people will be at the former Mirage Tavern, Brehon Pub, at the corner of Wells and Superior. This coming Thursday, registration, you can register, yes. Come in at 6:30.
Well, no,
is it full?
It's sold out.
It is?
Just sold out.
See, that's the lingering effect of your powerful writing. That's all I can attribute that to.
It's a wonderful story. Mike Royko said two things about it, I remember. He said, the great achievement was we finally proved what everybody knew, and he called it a great civics lesson, which it was in a sense.
Yeah, you know? No question. It was also, it was really also beautifully written. I will see you. I will see you at Brehon Pub, and I will come back here next Sunday and give everybody who can't go a report, because it is, without argument, of my lifetime, the most famous investigative series in the history of Chicago newspapers, even though I did one. Mine was only called Sex for Sale.
That was a heck of a series, too.
Well, with the great Tony Jannetty. We will compare notes, Norty. Congratulations, 40 years. And people, just go online and look up the book, The Mirage. You can find it on a lot of used book sites. And what I would do is keep your eyes peeled for some, you know, Amazon or Netflix series.
There is interest in a movie or a series now, and perhaps we'll get an ebook of The Mirage out sometime soon.
Fantastic. You will hear about it here. Norty, thanks a million. Thanks for staying up, and I'll see you Thursday.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, see ya. Norty, I call him Norty because his name in the series was Norty the Bartender. Well, thank you all for listening. Thank you, Aubrey Mumpower, for engineering. Thank you, Lise Graham, for a variety of producing chores.